Good morning. Thanks again for the opportunity to speak. I didn't realize until I started writing the sermon that the last time I spoke in April, I also taught on the book of John with a question for the title, Do You Want to Get Well? So I can guarantee you, Lord willing, there's a third time. It's going to be from John, and it's also going to be a question. With today's being, goodness, do you believe this? All right, so I was trying to come up with something to teach on, and I had some other sermon that I was preparing, and I felt like the Lord said, no, I want you to teach on something else. And I was going through my daily Bible reading, and I came across this story, and I think, like many of y'all, you have read through this many, many times if you've been through the book of John. And what struck me this time around was going through this, and it really was Martha's statement about the resurrection that caught my attention. It was in verse 24 where she says, I know that he, her brother Lazarus, will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. And why would that catch my attention? I'll tell you. Because how truthful it was, as truthful as it was, this is a very textbook answer. Of course I know that he's going to rise in the resurrection. If you take the totality, the context of this moment that they're in, clearly it's not sufficient for the moment. This is a truth that is a truth that is a truth that is a truth. But for what she's dealing with, it wasn't enough, and I'll explain in a second. So Martha's hurt, all right? Jesus shows up late, very, very late, obviously very late. Her brother's already in the tomb. The tomb is sealed. It's been 4 days. He's been dead for 4 days. Back then, you didn't wait very long. You know, you didn't wait and plan a funeral, you know, a few weeks out, a month out. You didn't wait till all the family was ready to come into town. You didn't wait until all of the arrangements had to be made and people got paid and all these things that go on with having a funeral. You just couldn't wait. So they send word to Jesus, my brother's sick. Jesus doesn't show up. All of this has happened. Now Jesus is on his way. Well, Martha's hurt. She's hurt because he wasn't there to heal her brother. In her mind, trust had been broken. This is someone who they called a family friend, who they asked for help, and he doesn't show up. So literally the first thing out of her mouth when she sees him isn't, Jesus, you know, it's what does she say? Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Is she wrong? No, she had expectations, right? So she says, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would have not died. And I think she wasn't, in the very least, if she wasn't angry, she's full of a lot of very strong feelings. She's so distraught that she meets Jesus, it says, outside the village of Bethany. He hadn't even gotten to the town, and she's right there willing to meet him at the edge of town. He hasn't even made it into town. So she's there waiting for him. So she softens a bit slightly, and she admits in verse 22, even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. So she's upset, but she doesn't deny God's power. But still, when she called, he didn't show up. You know, it says in verse 3, so the sisters had sent word saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. Jesus doesn't come. Lazarus gets even more sick. Jesus is still delayed, and eventually he dies. And neither Jesus nor any of his disciples, who Jesus said they all called Lazarus friend, none of them show up. So Jesus is not there to heal. The disciples are not there to do any comforting. They're left to bury their brother in this tomb and enter into a period of mourning. And still, when Jesus finally shows up, what does he do? He offers Martha a truth about the resurrection that she already knows. You know, he replies, Your brother Lazarus will rise again. And Martha replies, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. So Martha gives, like I said, the most textbook answer about the resurrection, something which we would all answer in talking about death. But let's pause and give Martha some credit, because it's impressive. It is impressive by itself that she believes in the resurrection, if you know something about the religious culture that she's in, right? Her nation's leadership, this Jewish sect called the Sadducees, what did they believe? Well, they didn't believe in any resurrection. This was a squabble between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, as they didn't believe in any resurrection at all. So it's profoundly special that Martha holds this truth, and she holds it in the face of the religious leadership that are over her in every possible way, in every station of life. So the Sadducees deny a resurrection. They deny the existence of angels and demons. They deny there being any spiritual world at all. They deny that there's even an afterlife. They believe that when you died, your soul was destroyed. And so there was no concept of penalty reward after this life was over. And it does kind of make you wonder then, what was the whole point of it all, right? If at a very fundamental level, this is all we have, What are they ruling over exactly? That could be a whole nother sermon. But anyway, she's holding this truth that we all sort of hold, you know, sort of, well, duh, yeah, of course he'll be raised in the resurrection. This is a very radical idea for her to have. And so she's giving a perfectly orthodox answer that she truly believes. She knows that he will rise again. And she's not wrong. Like I said, we believe that. We put our hope in that. The resurrection is a fundamental bedrock doctrine of the faith in Jesus Christ. And in saying that, ultimately she believes in the resurrection, she's willing to kind of give Jesus a pass for not being there because there's a backstop to it, right? I know I will see my brother one day. I know you weren't here. You didn't heal him. It's okay, Jesus. I know he's gonna rise up one day. So in doing that, she kind of softens things and consoles herself with the belief that ultimately, yes, her brother will be alive in the resurrection. But that truth, the truth that she had, wasn't enough for that moment. Jesus doesn't just leave it there. While it was true, Martha needed something more. She needed her faith in Jesus restored. Because, like I said, he's her friend and he didn't show up. The fact is, he wasn't there and she's hurt by that. And we're kind of confronted by that in this story. But she's not the only one who's hurt by that. There's somebody missing from this exchange outside of Bethany, and it's who? It's Mary. Mary didn't show. And that's what I want to talk about today. What does Jesus do to restore her faith? Because, like I said, there are two sisters in this story. This is an entire family that's grieving the death of a brother and a friend. And it's bigger than just Martha's statement about the resurrection. It's bigger than just that statement that hooked me in. We need to know who these women are. Who is Lazarus? Who is this family who called Jesus a friend, right? And what strikes me as interesting is that these sisters, Martha and Mary, they weren't like the other disciples who saw miracles every single day. They weren't like the group of disciples that followed Jesus, who slept out under the stars, that were eating grain from the fields, that were going town to town to Samaria, who were running and hiding essentially to keep Jesus from getting stoned. They weren't like the disciples that had left everything literally to follow him. Jesus said, "Come follow me." And they left their nets, they left their jobs, they left everything. But you've got Mary and Martha who are still at home in Bethany, and Lazarus who's still home in Bethany, and they're still loved by Jesus. He didn't call them from their home. He didn't call them from their responsibilities. He didn't call them from, you know, their day-to-day life. He didn't call them away from their family gatherings and all that. And Jesus still loved them. He called them friends. He didn't call them to sell everything, give to the poor, and follow him. But there's a story of a man that Jesus did call to do that. You remember the story about the rich young ruler? Jesus says there's one thing that he lacked. He needed to divest himself of everything, sell everything so that he could follow Jesus. Jesus called that man to poverty, but the rich young ruler, he couldn't bring himself to do it. He's probably a similar person to Mary and Martha and Lazarus and had a big estate and had servants and all of that. But it was something with this man who was different. Some people mistakenly think Jesus asked everyone to do that, to go become poor and follow after him, sell everything. And I think the point to be made here is that poverty itself is not inherently virtuous. What the disciples did was because Jesus had called them to do it. Mary and Martha were different. But not having wealth, poverty itself is not inherently virtuous, but having wealth might lead you away from the faith. The truth is that both poverty and wealth can make you a lover of money. So for that rich young ruler, wealth was a problem, and getting it was getting in the way of his devotion. Jesus calls it out, and the rich young ruler, we know how that story goes. He couldn't face the reality that his wealth wasn't an asset. It was a barrier to his faith. So why do I bring that up? I bring that up because Lazarus, Mary, and Martha, they weren't poor, not by any means, in fact. They were probably upper middle class, maybe even wealthy. Verse 38 says, kind of gives this away. It says, "So Jesus, again, being deeply moved within, he came to the tomb, and now it was a cave, and a stone was lying against it." That right away should tell you there's something uncommon about these people, because folks, it was not common for families to have burial caves back then. There's only so many caves, right? Only wealthy families had tombs and family tombs at that. So that tells you something about their means. This is a family with money. Jesus was their friends and he loved them. He didn't ask them to become poor for his sake or to follow after him. And apparently we should know at this point, because this is the raising of Lazarus comes about a week or so before the Passover, when we're getting to the end of the story. So by now we should know something about Mary and Martha. And we're introduced to them back in Luke. If you remember a story about a certain dinner party that Mary and Martha have. And if you don't know that, I'll read it too. So back in Luke 10, we're introduced to Mary and Martha way before Lazarus dies. And it says in Luke 10, now as they were traveling along, Jesus and his disciples, they entered the village. This is Bethany, right? And a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. She had a sister called Mary, who was seated at the Lord's feet, listening to his word. But Martha was distracted by all her preparations. And she came up to him and said, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the serving alone? Then tell her to help me. But the Lord answered and said to her, Martha, Martha, you are worried and bothered about so many things, but only one thing is necessary. For Mary has chosen the good part, which shall not be taken away from her. I think we've all kind of heard that story. But you ever notice in this story that it says that this big house is her home? She does the invitation. She invites Jesus and the disciples inside. She did the welcoming. It was her home. The estate was hers. She was likely the older sister, and she managed the household. So she's letting this man, Jesus, teach in her home while trying to hold a dinner party and obviously trying to hold it together. She's trying to be a good hostess and get everything ready, and her sister's just sitting there at Jesus' feet doing absolutely nothing. And maybe that resonates with some of us. But as far as we know, Jesus never asked, like I said, Martha to give up her home, her household, or for Mary or Lazarus to do the same. And I think it's an important point because we all kind of fall into that category as disciples, right? We're not the kind that sleep under stars. We're not the kind that eat random food from strangers. Jesus is not asking most of us to leave our homes and follow him, but we are the Marys and the Marthas, and we are still disciples. We're not called to leave our villages. We're not called to leave, or to not care for our sick family members. And there are real times when we pray for Jesus to show up and evidently he doesn't. And so our timeline anyway, not in our timeline anyway, and not in the way that we expected. And here we have Martha telling Jesus she knows Lazarus will rise again in the resurrection. So I'm thinking, did Jesus show up just to tell her that? Certainly not. Jesus had more in store. In fact, he tells his disciples exactly what he's going to do, but he doesn't tell Mary and Martha yet. They don't know what's about to happen. But what Jesus says next changes everything. He says to her, I'm the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, even if he dies, and everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? He asks her. And she replies to him, yes, Lord, I have believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, even he who comes into this world. Now, let's pause again just to marvel at Martha, who is so spiritually wise. Her reply sounds so familiar. I don't know if you caught that, but when she says, you are the Christ, the Son of God, does that sound familiar? Did somebody else say something very similar to that? Does it ring a bell? Yeah, Twilight, you're nodding your head. Yeah, so somebody else, Peter, right? Yeah, so way back in Matthew 16, long time ago, I get locked, relatively speaking, early in Jesus's ministry, he says to them, he says, but who do you say that I am? This is a question to all his disciples. And Simon Peter answers, he says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. The same exact thing that Martha says. Jesus says to him, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. So folks, let's recognize Martha, who has also heard from the Father, who revealed this to her as well, not just Peter. Peter was special, but so was Martha. It's interesting. So we have Martha from Bethany, who is saying the same thing as the Apostle Peter, that God the Father entrusts her with this very special, precious truth, the same as Peter, that Jesus is the Christ. But, and here's the difference. She can say it in the morning of the death of her brother. She can say it while carrying the burden of this family household who's all grieving the death of her brother. She can say it while still being angry at Jesus, which I think is an interesting distinction. So it blows my mind how strong this woman is. And she goes from all the way back in Luke 10, worrying about hosting a dinner party, to here she's standing here now, revealing the secrets of heaven while having buried her brother just a day or two before. Just wow. So Martha's special. And we think back on that dinner party like, Martha, Martha. It's kind of a joke, right? Within the church, kind of this cute little joke. Martha, Martha, you're worried about many things. And I think I've said it before, and you maybe don't hear it as often now, but that whole Martha, Martha thing that we often, maybe in our minds, we picture some finger wagging or something. I don't know. I can't project what Jesus was thinking. I don't think he's scolding her. But the point I want to make is that actually marks her as being very special, because there are only 7 times in the Bible when God uses a name twice in a row. And I'm going to name them all. And they're all profoundly significant moments of calling. This is when God calls a person. So we go all the way back to Genesis 22, verse 11, Abraham, Abraham. But the angel of the Lord called from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. Okay, so Genesis 46, 2, God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. And we get to Exodus. We've got Moses, Moses. And God said, and Moses says, here I am. This is God calling to Moses from the bush. Fast forward to Samuel, 1 Samuel 3:10. The Lord came and stood and called us at other times, Samuel, Samuel. And Samuel says, speak, for your servant is listening. We keep going. And Simon Peter, here we're in the New Testament. Here's Simon again. And Luke, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has demanded permission to sift you like wheat. And then one more time in the book of Acts, and this time it's with Saul. And it says, he fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to him, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And then you have Martha, where Jesus is saying, Martha, Martha, you're worried about many things. So we could see it as finger wagging. We could see that God had his hand on her life and wanted something more from her, for her, than just worrying all the time. I think that's kind of cool. So she's the only woman in this list, and I think that God had a special place in her life and knew her potential. So we know Martha's a worrier. She gets stuck in her head, as I do as well. Some of you do as well, I'm sure. And maybe for her, your grief was in intellectual exercise like Martha. She is stuck in her head, and she just can't reconcile the fact that her friend Jesus, who could have healed her brother, hasn't shown up yet. And think about my dad died a couple of years ago, and I remember feeling like I was estranged from him. I remember feeling I didn't know what to think. I didn't know what to feel. So I have as many of believers do, I have a set of truths that I hold up to, and I hold up the same truth that Martha holds up and says, yeah, may I'll see him again in the resurrection. But it wasn't enough for me. And it still isn't. It's still something I wrestle with God with is what do I do with this? What do I do with this? And I don't picture myself as Mary standing at the end of the village, but at some point maybe, and I pray it'll make more sense to me, but I did feel stuck. And so I identify a little bit with Martha's frustration of what do I do with that? How do I get closure? Martha's just looking for closure. And Jesus, I think, gives her some as we keep going in the story. Jesus asks her a question. He tells her that I am the resurrection and the life. And he says, do you believe this? And I think the reason he asked her that is he needed to ground her thinking in a stronger truth than just this textbook. Although very special, almost rebellious belief that the resurrection is a thing, but he needed to ground her in something else, that there is no resurrection without Jesus. He is the source of that life, and that life is standing right in front of her. He wants her to understand that the dead don't rise in that last day, that the resurrection is not this abstract event that just happens like the end of the ice age or whatever. Like, it isn't just a thing that happens. It's on the timeline of geology. Like, the resurrection is just a thing that's going to happen. It happens because someone calls us. So the resurrection day, we don't rise unless we are called by someone. That someone is the one standing in front of her. And in 1 Thessalonians, it breaks it out for us. This is 1 Thessalonians 4:16. It says, for the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout. There's a calling, right? With the voice of the archangel and the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise. So a calling must occur first. And we're about to have a calling in the story. Jesus is going to call Lazarus out of the tomb, right? And when she had said this, she went away and called Mary, her sister, saying secretly, the teacher's here and he's calling for you. And when she heard it, she got up quickly and was coming to him. He said, there's two sisters in this story. So Martha heard something in Jesus' reply and question, do you believe this? Something that her textbook answer about the resurrection couldn't do for her. Jesus comforted her by letting her know that he is life itself. And then Mary arrives. She's mad too, but she's also emotionally exhausted. She's been at home. She's been with the mourners. She's been crying. She doesn't live in her head like Martha. She wears her heart on her sleeve. She's the one who sat at Jesus's feet at the dinner party, just soaking up Jesus's presence. In verse 32, it says, therefore, Mary came where Jesus was. She saw him and fell at his feet again at her feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. So she's been saving this question for herself as well. She's not waiting for him at the edge of town, but she's upset as well. So Jesus sees her weeping, and those who came with her, the mourners, also weeping. And what does Jesus do? When Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews came with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled and said, "Where have you laid him?" And they said to him, "Lord, come and see." And it says, Jesus wept, with the shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept. Does he test her theology? Does he ask her about the resurrection? Does he try to get her out of her head? No, he just weeps with her. He just cries with her. He doesn't try to explain himself. He doesn't offer her another sermon so she can sit at his feet and marvel at his teachings. He offers his own vulnerability. This is the same Mary, and it's pointed out in verse 2, that poured out that expensive perfume over Jesus' feet. And if you remember something about that perfume, right, it was worth what? It was worth a year's wages. A lot of money. Like I said, these folks have money, right? But she did that to show her extreme sacrifice and devotion for him. So we see Jesus weeping here, and he returns the favor and he pours out his tears for her. And I just think that she needed something different that her sister didn't need. Mary needed some different reconciliation. So Jesus restores trust with her by crying with her, offering something more precious than words. He offers to enter into her own pain, and he cries with her. And he honors Mary with his own tears. And Mary, well, she's special too, because she's the only person in the Gospels that Jesus cried for. You know, Jesus wept over Jerusalem as a whole when he got there. He wept over the condition of Jerusalem, and he knew it was to come, and he could see their future. And so he cries. And Jesus, he weeps over his own coming death. We know that he sweated as with blood in the Garden of Gethsemane. I mean, he knows what's coming. And I would have to think that Jesus would have cried over his own cousin's death, John the Baptist, when he found out that his cousin was beheaded. It says that he retreated alone when he got the news. So he may have cried when he was by himself, but we know that Mary got Jesus's public tears. All right. And it says in verse 36, so the Jews were saying, "See how he loved them." Mary needed to see that Jesus did care for her. So before I get into what comes next, I have to ask, you know, why did Jesus delay showing up? Why put them through all this? Why put them through the death, the illness, before the death, the illness, the burial, the mourning, all of this rushed planning that had to happen that was probably very expensive? The meals, the tears, the uncertainty, the anger. Why bring Lazarus back from paradise? Let's just be honest. I mean, if he's dead and Jesus said he's dead, he's not here. He's in paradise, right? Why bring him back to this world full of sin, sickness, and death so that he can die twice? And in verse 4, Jesus explains why. He says, "The sickness is not to end in death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by it." So Jesus offers us a hard explanation. God is writing Lazarus's death into his story for his glory alone, for his purposes. And that's a hard truth to swallow. Our lives are the same. It's hard to swallow the idea that God created us for a role in his story and not the other way around. God is not cast into our story. We are cast into his. We're literally reading. I'm reading from his story, right? We are part of that same story. So becoming a Christian, it's not bolting Jesus onto our lives as a new feature or an accessory. He's not an upgrade for our lives. And I think you're like, well, that sounds awfully silly. But if you think about how we live and we think about ourselves as Christians, a lot of times it's, I'm this and that. I am Adam and I am a Christian. I am Adam and I have this job and I am this and that. And it is an aspect of who I am. But to think about it rightly, becoming a Christian is not bolting Jesus onto our lives. It's accepting Jesus's story and his claims. We are put into his story. We are, I mean, to use more technical terms, we are grafted into his life. We are grafted into the people of God. We are brought into his story. And sure, it must have been hard for Jesus to choose to stay a few days longer where he was. It says he stayed 2 days longer where he was before he came because he wanted to make sure that Lazarus was good and dead, right? Really dead, smelly dead. Before he showed up to wake him up. So Martha's worried. So anyway, we get to the tomb and Martha's worried that when they roll the stone away on the tomb, that there will be a stench. It says that because he's been dead for 4 days and always, Martha's always worrying. She's like, just the facts. I mean, if you roll the stone away, I'm just saying Jesus is not going to be pleasant. And then what does Jesus reply? He says, if you believe, what did I say? If you believe, you will see the glory of God. If you believe, you will see the glory of God. And what he means is this is you're going to have to get past the smell to see the miracle because it's there. I mean, the stench of death is there. Don't trust your nose, but trust your eyes. So you can still see God resurrect things in the midst of a dead, smelly relationships. You can still see God resurrect things in places where you think God won't go. I mean, you're dragging the teacher to a cemetery, right? You can still see God resurrect things on behalf of people that you think God doesn't care about anymore. But if you want to see the miracle, you have to see past the smell. So I think it's an invitation that we don't avoid the stench of death in those situations, in that relationship, because life can come forth from places where only death should be. Do you believe this? Then the story ends. Jesus cries out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." Again, the resurrection. There's a calling, right? There's a calling, and here we have one for somebody very specific, Lazarus. The man who had died came forth, bound hand and foot with wrappings, and his face was wrapped around with a cloth. And Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." Now, if he were dead, this would be a bad thing to do, right? Because if you touch an unclean body, that makes you unclean. And you have Jesus, the prophet, the teacher, whatever you want to call him, we call him the Son of God, telling people to touch a body that was dead. To your question about did he smell himself, does that make them unclean? That leaves all kinds of interesting questions, right? Are you touching a dead body or is this a formerly dead body? Jesus isn't interested in any of the mental games that go along with that. But he just says, unbind the man, let him go, take the wrappings off. Then he says something interesting. It says something interesting. Therefore, many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what he had done believed in him. It's this supporting cast. Sometimes there's a story in the Bible where Jesus heals a girl who he says she's just sleeping, even though we know she's dead. And he chases everybody out because the mourners are in there and they're all crying. And Jesus is going to raise her from the dead. And they all laugh at him, right? He chases them all out, everybody but the parents and a couple of his close disciples. And he says, "Talitha cum, rise, little girl." And what you find is in this world is that when somebody died, you often, if you didn't have family to mourn with you, you would pay mourners. You had professional mourners. You had people that you would pay to come cry with you and make a big scene. And you'd have the funeral march and you'd go down the street and you'd have people that you paid to wail and weep and wear black and all that. But you have this supporting cast who's come with Mary because Mary's the one who wears her heart on her sleeve. She's the one who's just wailing at home, who can't bring herself to see Jesus until her sister calls. But it says that they saw what had happened and they believed. So it's a supporting cast, those who were trying to comfort Mary, who received something that they were not looking for. Hear me out. Mary's pain was a vehicle for others to see the glory of God. And like I said, we're being written into God's story. And as hard as it can be to swallow, some of our pain is a vehicle for others to see the glory of God. So just days before, these sisters, they had sealed their brother in a cave. They had to deal with the disillusionment that Jesus, their friend who had healed complete strangers, couldn't find the urgency to heal their brother. That makes me mad, but they couldn't find the urgency to heal their brother, someone Jesus loved. And they sat with that anger and that disillusionment for days. For some of us, maybe it's years. Some of us, the grief is still real and we've stopped waiting for miracles. And maybe the resurrection is just a textbook reality. And that's where we've left it. It's still true, but it's insufficient to get us through our moment. Like I said, I'm still dealing with the death of my dad. But I'll conclude with some thoughts on these two sisters, just to make it personal. Again, these are exceptional women, and we see them in these tiny little stories and these vignettes. But realize that Jesus didn't just call them friends; he saw special things in them. Maybe you're a Martha, And God didn't show up for you when you called. Maybe you even went to the edge of the village, so to speak, metaphorically, to wait for him. And maybe you've broken trust with the Lord over it. And now you're left stuck sort of in your head, trying to pick up the pieces with the truth that you do have. You're trying to make sense of the distance with God that hasn't healed. And for you, I pray that God shows you part of himself that your thoughts have never imagined. Jesus showed Martha a better, a new and better truth, that he is the life. I pray that you see something new for his glory, that you can continue walking with him. And maybe you're Mary and you've been left alone to grieve. You know, maybe it's just you, your sister is dealing with it in her own way. And you're back at home, and maybe others are surrounding you to comfort you. Maybe you've been left alone to grieve all by yourself. And maybe you spent a life pouring out, maybe not costly perfume, but you spent a life pouring out the best of yourself for Jesus, for his church, for other people. And you wonder, what was it all for? You've wasted the best of you had for a friend who didn't show up for you. And that costly perfume you poured out, for me, it was my 20s. I spent my youth serving the church. We spent day and night even serving the church. And maybe the fragrance of your sacrifice that you gave long ago has worn off. And you're left wondering, well, what's left for you? What does God have for you? And I pray that you let God find a way to pour something back into your life. Maybe it's not his tears that you need, literal tears, but some other means of honor or acknowledgement or feeling valued or purpose that's missing from your life. You're done crying and you just need to be filled back up as Mary was and called out of the house. She wasn't stuck in her head, but she was stuck in her house. And Jesus called her out, said, Mary, the teacher's asking for you. So I pray that you receive that call. That's it. Amen.